Welcome to The Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder-Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. So we're in Daniel chapter 11, and God willing, with a little bit of luck and a tailwind, we may finish Daniel tonight. Went through last time the soap opera that is the history of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And as we go into Daniel chapter 11, we're going to have the king of the north and the king of the south are going to be the two major players. Basically, they are the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And as I said before, when Alexander died, his empire was divided among his four generals. Cassander and Lysimachus got Greece and Macedonia, basically. Seleucus and Ptolemy got Syria and Egypt, respectively. So I think we made it down to Daniel 11:5, and 1 through 4 are basically the process of getting from Persia to the divided Greek Empire. We've been through that several times. I don't plan to go through it again. So now verse 5 in Daniel 11. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger, and he shall rule, and his authority shall be great authority. After some years they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But he shall be given up, and her attendants who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. What we're talking about here is Antiochus II. He is the king of the north that we're talking about. And equivalent in the Ptolemaic Empire, we're talking about Ptolemy II. And Ptolemy II has a daughter named of Bernice or Bernice. I don't have any idea how the lady herself pronounced it. But anyway, there was a war between basically Ptolemy II and Antiochus II. And in that, Ptolemy prevailed. And one of the things that he did is he basically gave Bernice as a wife to Antiochus II. Now, Antiochus II already had a wife, Laodice. Laodice, again, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but this is the lady after whom the city of Laodicea is named. What happened is he put her away, married Bernice, and then after his death, Laodice murdered Bernice. As I say, this is a soap opera. So Laodice murders Bernice, which just naturally ticks her brother off, and her brother is Ptolemy III. He goes to war to avenge his sister, and that doesn't work out so well. So then we get down here to Seleucus II, who was a king for a short time, and he marries, notice the similarity, Laodice I, Laodice II, and on the other side you'll have Bernice I, Bernice II, until we get into the Cleopatras. And then we'll go all the way down to Cleopatra, I believe, 7. 7 is the famous one that they made all the movies about and Shakespeare wrote the play about, Caesar and Cleopatra. That's Cleopatra 7, who is beyond what we're interested in, unless you happen to like Shakespeare. So anyway, the next Antiochus that we get to of any consequence is Antiochus III, who is called Antiochus the Great. All right, so let's now come back to the text. So we've gotten past 6, and we're now down to 7. From a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. So from a branch of her roots, who is her? Bernice, or Bernice. But her root is the Ptolemy line, right? She comes from the Ptolemy line. So her root is the Ptolemaic kings, and so from a branch of her root is going to come one who, from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter, meaning the king of the north, shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So this is, as I say, this soap opera goes on for a couple hundred years. And it isn't completely clear from Daniel which one of the wars of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies we're talking about. But basically what happens is the next big Seleucid king is Antiochus III the Great. And he managed to restore a bunch of the empire and so forth. He has marries Laodice III. Again, you can't tell the players without the numbers on them. You know, it's sort of like that's why they put numbers on baseball players, so you can tell them apart. They all wear the same uniform. Now, they have three children. So Antiochus III or Antiochus the Great and Laodice III have three children. Seleucus IV, Antiochus IV, and actually they have six children, but the only ones that bear up here are these three. And notice that Laodice marries both of her brothers. And as I said last time, it's not kinky because she married them one at a time. Anyway, so Seleucus IV dies. His son, Demetrius I, should become the king. But the problem with Demetrius I is he's a hostage in Rome. One of the things that happened all throughout history is when you had two armies that contended and one empire prevailed over the other, the one who prevailed typically took hostages of the royal families of the defeated one. That's how Daniel got to Babylon, remember? He was a hostage in the same sense. So when Rome prevailed against the Seleucid Empire, this guy, Demetrius I, was taken back to Rome as a hostage. Well, Demetrius here is still captive in Rome. Basically, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, talks his way into becoming king. So now we'll read about that. So I'm all the way down now to maybe verse 10 in Daniel 11. His sons, the king of the north, shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces and shall keep coming and overflow and pass through and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north and shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. Then the multitude is taken over, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again rise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. You getting all this? So where am I now? Verse 14, maybe? In these times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. What this appears to refer to is when one of the Seleucids basically comes down, he treats the Jews relatively well. And the Jews join up with him, join his army, and go against Egypt. And as a result, there's a royal decree which says basically that Jews become free citizens of the cities in the Greek Empire that the Seleucids control. So this, the violent among your own people, refers to Jews who join with the Seleucids to attack the Ptolemies in Egypt. And as a result of that, Jerusalem gets favorable treatment and Jews in the Seleucid Empire get favorable treatment. This, by the way, is from Josephus. So 15, then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. All right, this appears to be a siege of Jerusalem where the Seleucids run the Ptolemies out of Jerusalem. Again, that's happened in secular history, you'll notice that the battleground between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids is basically Israel. So they fight up and down through Israel quite a bit. One of the things that the Seleucids do, this is before Antiochus Epiphanes now, they free Jerusalem and, as I say, give citizenship rights to the Jews in the empire because of the good that they do them. The other thing that's going to happen, and I don't remember where it is in Daniel here, is quite a number of Jews are going to be captured by the Egyptians under the Ptolemies. The Ptolemaic emperor, I don't remember which one it was, is going to issue a decree of emancipation and is basically going to buy all the Jewish captives from the royal treasury and set them free. So the Jews, even though they're sort of in the middle of the soccer field, if you will, and everybody that goes back and forth runs over them, they do seem to make out fairly well in all this. Verse 16, but he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall prevail before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. And again, the glorious land here is Israel. He shall set his face to come with strength of his whole kingdom, and shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Back to our soap opera. Cleopatra the First. This is who's being talked about there. The daughter of women is Cleopatra the First. Notice that she is the daughter of Antiochus the Third. And the deal was they struck a truce, and the two of them were going to go against Rome. What Antiochus the Third does is give his daughter, Cleopatra the First, in marriage to Ptolemy the Fifth. You following all this? And the idea is that she's apparently the apple of daddy's eye, and he expects that she is going to be his eyes and ears in the court of the Ptolemies in Egypt. Doesn't work out that way. She switches allegiance, and she, in fact, is faithful to her husband. So the whole enterprise doesn't work out. So reading 17 again, about the second half, he shall give him the daughter of women, Cleopatra the First, to destroy the kingdom. The kingdom in this case is apparently Rome. But it shall not stand or be to his advantage. His plans don't work out, and the whole thing falls apart, and they don't attack. Verse 18, afterwards he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Fourth, indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. All right, so now we're coming up to verse 20. And in the commentaries I've read, there's sort of two opinions about this. Opinion number one is verses 1 through 19 are pretty accurate with respect to the wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids that happened over a period of a couple hundred years. Lots of commentators believe that starting in verse 20, it becomes prophetic. You know, I'm not a historian. Don't even play one on TV. I don't know. Some of the stuff is clearly reflective of Antiochus the Fourth, who is called Epiphanes. Some of it starts to reach farther forward because it obviously didn't happen in her history. Verse 20. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. This is the guy that's killed by his own army. I think this is Seleucus the Fourth. He's only a king for a very short time. Verse 21. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain a kingdom by flatteries. That's Antiochus the Fourth. Remember I told you the rightful king is Demetrius the First, who is a hostage. Well, instead of sending off and getting this guy back and bringing him to the king, what Antiochus the Fourth does is basically talks his way into the throne. And he is a usurper. That part is historical. 22. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and shall become strong with a small people. This doesn't seem to be historical. What happens to Antiochus IV is he gets ready to do the traditional thing and go invade Egypt. And so he's got his army all hatted up, and he's heading down south, and an envoy from Rome meets him on the beach in Israel. And the envoy from Rome has got a letter from the Roman Senate saying, if you attack Egypt, Rome will attack you. Well, he's already had a tangle with Rome, and that didn't go very well. So he doesn't want to tangle with Rome again. So he says to the Roman envoy on the beach, hang on a second, let me take this letter from the Senate back to my advisors, and I'll come back and tell you what we're going to do. The Roman envoy takes a stick and draws a line in the sand around him and says, basically, you're going to give me an answer before you leave this circle, or I'm going back to Rome and saying you've refused. So at that point, he thought about it for a few minutes and said, okay, I will do what the Senate says. Now, that just sort of naturally ticked him off. So he goes back, and at that point, he begins this program of Hellenizing the Jews, or another way to say it, of exterminating Judaism. And of course, all of that is written up in the books of the Maccabees. But that's the incident that starts that whole thing, because he is ticked sideways about having been humiliated by Rome. Maybe 24. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done. Scattering among them plunder, spoils, and goods, he shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south, and with great army, and the king of the south will wage war with an exceeding great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plot shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail. For the end is yet to be at the time appointed. He shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. So this idea of having his heart set against the Holy Covenant, it's talking about Antiochus. And again, we see the whole thing also in Revelation 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. But it shall not be this time as it was before. For ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. Okay, this is the business with the Roman envoy on the beach that I was telling you about. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. As I say, these are the events of the books of the Maccabees, where he comes in and his intention is to Hellenize the Jews, which means turn them into Greeks. Those who cooperate, he gives positions of prestige, authority, and power. Those who don't cooperate, he brutally suppresses and kills. Of course, you all know how the Maccabean War started off. The way he co-opted the religious would be he would send a squad of Greek soldiers into a town, and they would get the most prominent men in the town, and they would go have a barbecue of pulled pork. If the prominent men of the town partake of the pork, the less prominent people in the town would follow suit. That worked just fine until he got to Moedin, I believe it is, which is where John Hyrcanus was, who was a priest. And Hyrcanus said, not only no, but hell no, slaughtered the squad of Greek soldiers, ran off into the hills, and gathered other rebels around him, and they became the Maccabees, which means hammer, and they drove the Greeks out of there for a time. and they, after they kept him out of there for quite some time, the rabbis say, and I kind of like this, that what tribe would Hyrcanus be from? Levi, he's a priest. And as I've been fond of saying recently, if you need somebody to break out of Egypt or you need somebody to run the Greeks off or something, you want a Levite, somebody with a temper. That's really great for running them out. It is not, however, so good for governing. When you go to governing, you want somebody preferably from Judah, perhaps also from Joseph, but somebody with a different temperament. So the Hashmonean dynasty, which is the dynasty that the Maccabees founded, didn't last a long time. And as I said, the rabbinic thought on that is because they had the wrong tribe trying to be king. And as I say, it makes sense to me. Doesn't mean it's right, it just makes sense. I'm maybe down to 33. So let's pick it up at 32. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help. And many join themselves to them with flattery. And some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. For it still awaits the appointed time. And again, that can be, as I say, the Maccabean rebellion, or it can be the time yet future, which is spoken of in Revelation. 36. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers, or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his father did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many, shall divide the land for a price. And again, this is starting to mix Revelation stuff with Antiochus stuff. He did not magnify himself as a god. What he wound up doing is he sacrificed a pig in the temple and he erected a statue of Zeus. So again, I think that this is starting to mix Revelation stuff with the stuff that happens at the time of the Maccabees. But that's just me, because there's stuff here that doesn't match anymore. 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen, and with many ships. He shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab, and the main part of the Ammonites. This is starting to be end time stuff. 42. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver, and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountains, yet he shall come to an end with none to help him. This could certainly be stuff that happened in secular history, but it's more likely to be stuff in the future. Onward to 12. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as has never been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. Books are mentioned several times in Scripture. It isn't clear what this book is. You can certainly infer that it's the book of life, You could also infer that it's the book of the wars of the Lord. I just don't know. But those who are written in that book will be delivered. Verse 2. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. As I read Revelation, and as I read Paul, there are two resurrections. The first resurrection is the one that happens at Yeshua's return. And that is a resurrection of those who are his own, believers. The next resurrection is before the final judgment in the lake of fire. The way this is written, it seems to lump those two things together. So many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. There isn't anything in there that precludes 1,000 years between those two resurrections, which is what I believe will happen, but there's anything that requires it either. Again, I'm not sure what to do with that. Do with it as you, that seems right to you. Verse 3, and those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. A couple of things about Daniel. I hope I said this early on in Daniel. It's great indoor sport to try and figure out how the events of Daniel are going to map onto world history. But this is a sealed book until some time. I don't know when that time is. You know, the comment wasn't right now. But reading the writings of great men of God over the past 2,000 years, and I have not read all of it, but I've read some of them, the number of them who believed that they were at the time of the end, I mean, that was just sort of a standard belief. So for us to believe it, that we are at the time of the end means we are in good company. But again, this isn't something I'm going to sell real estate based on. And there are people who do sell real estate based on that. And up until now, they have all been embarrassed. I firmly believe at some point somebody will not be embarrassed, but I don't know when that is. Now, one thing that's interesting, which most expositors tag onto here, is many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase. That seems to fit today. Knowledge is increasing exponentially. You can be anywhere in the world within 24 hours. I mean, not literally, but you can be at any airport in the world within 24 hours. And from there, it's usually just a motorcycle ride to wherever it is you want to go. So many running to and fro and knowledge increasing seems to be a characteristic of the time we are living in now. Having said that, I still haven't seen anything that would cause me to sell real estate. Understand that the book is sealed until some time. I don't claim to be any great expositor of Daniel. I've read lots of commentaries on it, most of which I disagree with. But again, anybody can play. Verse 5. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others stood, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time. So crossing that with Revelation, the thing that is known as the time of Jacob's trouble, the great tribulation, all of those last a time, times, and half a time, which is 3.5 years. So this seems to be referring to what we know as the Great Tribulation, simply because the time frames match. 1,280 days, 42 months. And it's given in time, times, and half a time, it's given in days, and it's given in months. And I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the stream, he raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time. And that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things shall be finished. That matches with what we call the Great Tribulation. And of course, if you are a rapture person, you are of the opinion that that's going to be the Jews and all the Christians are going to be up in the mezzanine watching. I don't happen to be of that persuasion, but if you are, that's okay. I mean, neither one of us knows. My personal opinion is there isn't anywhere in the Tanakh this idea of a rescue or a rapture. What happens is we get taken out of Egypt, which is the world, and we get taken into the wilderness by somebody like Moses. As I say, it is nothing to lose skin over, because when it happens, we'll know. And until it happens, I don't think we will know for sure. But anyway, when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things will be finished. So again, that seems to indicate the end of the Great Tribulation, where the man, the one who is to come, man of sin, the Antichrist, whatever you call it, is going to suppress Israel for 3.5 years. Verse 8, I heard, but I did not understand. We're in good company. I don't understand either. I heard, but I did not understand. Then I said, O my Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things? He said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly. And none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. And from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed, which is 3.5 years, 42 months. Okay? A time, times, and half a time. A time, times, and half a time depends on what you think the length of the year is for Daniel. And we had that conversation last time when we were going through Sir Richard Anderson and some of the more modern commentators on figuring out Daniel's timeline. Anderson believed that it was 362 days, or 360 days in a year, which would be 1,290 days, 3.5 years, time, times, and half a time. Okay, all that would match up. Another commentator, a guy named Reagan, I think, believes 365 days, in which case that doesn't match. Blessed is he who waits and arrives at the 1,335 days. But go your way till the end, and you shall rest and shall stand in your allotted place at the end of days. I have no idea what 1,335 is. It is 45 days beyond 1,290 days, which if 1,290 days is 42 months, it takes you to 43 and a half months. And again, I don't know what that means. Comment was that there are those who think that between Yeshua's touching down at 1,290 days and his completion of putting, you know, getting the nations in a position where they can be ruled with a rod of iron will be 45 days. And again, I have no reason to argue with that. It's a perfectly good supposition. I just don't know. Verse 13, but go your way till the end, and you shall rest and shall stand in your allotted place at the end of days. So again, this is clearly talking, I think, about resurrection. Whether that is during the millennial reign or after, I don't know. One of the things that Ezekiel indicates is that during the millennial reign, David will be on the throne in Jerusalem, which is, you know, red-headed David raised from the dead. It is not inconceivable that David would need a really good chief of staff, which Daniel would make, because that's what he did. You know, he was chief of staff to both the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. So the idea that Daniel might be raised for service during the millennial kingdom is perfectly credible to me. I'm not predicting it. I'm simply saying that's a possibility. Would somebody like closing prayer?